Let's turn to the book of Esther, chapter 8. Today is the final episode in our study of the book of Esther. And before we get into the final events recorded in this book, I'd like to recount once more what we have seen take place up to this point in the story. Our story takes place in the great Persian Empire in the capital city of Susa around 500 BC. And through the sovereign work of God, a young Jewish woman named Esther, barely a teenager at the time, is selected as queen and wife of King Xerxes. She and her much older cousin Mordecai are the main characters in the book. Mordecai has raised Esther as his own daughter since she lost her parents when she was very young. A little later, King Xerxes appointed a man named Haman as the number two man in the kingdom, having authority over all of the other royal officials. The king commanded the other officials to bow down and pay honor to Haman, and everyone complied with that command except for Mordecai, who knew what kind of man Haman was and that he was a long-standing enemy of the Jewish people. Well, Haman was enraged when he saw that Mordecai would not bow down and show him respect. In fact, he was so angry, it tells us, that he looked for a way not only to kill Mordecai, but to exterminate the entire Jewish population within the kingdom. Haman's plan was to have everyone in the kingdom turn on the Jews, men, women, and children, on the 13th day of the 12th month, killing them and plundering their goods. Well, adding intrigue to the story at this point, neither the king nor Haman knows yet that Esther is a Jew or that she and Mordecai are related. Well, Mordecai, he goes to his cousin Esther, who is the queen, and tells her that she must go to the king and plead for her people. There was a big problem with that, though. No one, not even the queen, was allowed to appear before the king without first him summoning them. If anyone attempted to appear before the king without his invitation, they were executed. There was only one exception. If, when a person appeared before the king, he extended his golden scepter to them, their life would be spared and they would be allowed to speak. Well, Esther initially refuses to risk her life to attempt to appear before the king. But Mordecai tells Esther that it may have been for this very moment that the Lord has raised her up as queen. So after some very deep soul-searching, Esther agrees to try to speak to the king. She asked Mordecai and the other Jews to fast and pray for 3 days, and then she would go in and try to speak to the king. And if she perished, she perished. Well, at the end of the 3-day period of fasting and praying, Esther went into the king's hall, not knowing what kind of reception that she's going to receive from him. But to her great surprise and relief, she's greeted with a smile from the king. In fact, he extends his scepter to her and he asks, "What can I do for you, Esther? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you." Esther humbly stood before the king and told him that her request was simply an invitation to a dinner party that she had prepared for him. She asked that the king also bring Haman with him. Well, at the dinner party, the king again asks Esther what her request is. And again, she tells him that all she would like him to do at this point is to come again to another dinner party that she's going to have for him tomorrow. And at that dinner party, she'll tell him what her request is. And she asks that he would bring Haman with him again. Well, on his way home that day, Haman is feeling pretty great until he sees Mordecai, who continues to refuse to bow down to him or give him any honor. Haman is filled with anger, but it says that he manages to control himself until he gets home. And when he gets home, he begins to lament to his wife and his friends how he can have no satisfaction in life until Mordecai is somehow disposed of. His wife and his friends suggest that he have him executed. Build a gallows 75 feet high, have him hanged on it, and then you can go to your party and be happy. Well, he liked that idea, so he ordered that this gallows be built near his house immediately. Well, that same night, the king was not able to sleep, so he had the record of his reign brought in and read to him, and he discovered that he had left a debt of gratitude unpaid to Mordecai for saving his life, who had uncovered an assassination plot against the king. The next morning, Haman came into the palace, intending to speak to the king and get his permission to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he just had built. But before he can ask, the king tells him that he wants to bestow special honor on a certain person for a great deed that they have done. The king asks Haman for his ideas about how this certain person should be honored. Well, Haman, being so full of himself, assumes that the king must be wanting to honor him. I mean, who else would he want to honor? So he tells the king to have a special robe put on this person and have him led through the city streets on one of the king's best horses, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man that the king delights to honor." Well, horror of horrors for Haman. The man the king wanted to honor was Mordecai, the very man Haman hates more than any other on the planet. In fact, the king likes Haman's idea so much that he commands him to do it exactly as he is described, and he wants Haman to be the very person to lead that royal horse throughout the city and proclaim before Mordecai that this is what is done for the man that the king wants to honor. Well, this was just the beginning of Haman's downfall, because later that day at the dinner party with the king and queen, the queen told the king that the very man that they're eating with, Haman, has designs to destroy her people and to have her killed. The king gets up in a rage and he leaves the room. And while he's gone, Haman falls on the couch next to Esther to plead for his life. And just at that moment, the king walks back into the room. He sees Haman stretched out on the couch before his wife, assumes that he's making advances towards her, and orders that he be executed immediately. Well, one of the king's aides is there and he goes, "Hey, king, actually, there's a 75-feet-high gallows that Haman had built yesterday to hang Mordecai on, the man that you honored. Great idea! Hang him on that gallows!" And so he was. Then the king gave Esther the estate of Haman. The king gave Mordecai his royal signet ring. Mordecai assumed Haman's job as the number two man in the kingdom. And now, the conclusion to our story, Esther 8, beginning in verse 3. It says, "Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Then the king extended the gold scepter to Esther, and she arose and stood before him. 'If it pleases the king,' she said, 'and if he regards me with favor and thinks it the right thing to do, and if he is pleased with me,'" how would you like someone to approach you like that? "'let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, devised and wrote to destroy the Jews in all the king's provinces. For how can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family?'" See, although the evil Haman has been brought down and destroyed, his diabolical plan for having the Jews exterminated is still in effect. The royal decree that has been issued by Haman directing all of the people of the kingdom to turn on the Jews, killing them and plundering their goods on the 13th day of the 12th month is still in effect. And this is what Esther is pleading before the king to have him overrule. Her people are still in serious jeopardy. Verse 7, King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have hanged him on the gallows. Now write another decree in the king's name in behalf of the Jews, as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked." The king points out to them that he cannot simply overrule this previous decree, not even himself. It's irrevocable once it's been sealed with his signet ring in his name. The only alternative available is to issue another decree that will somehow effectively neutralize the first one. So he gives Mordecai and Esther the authority and permission to write another decree in his name and with his ring as they think best to actually accomplish that particular task. So with the approval of the king, Mordecai immediately sets the royal secretaries to work, drafting another decree, which is then sent out to all of the peoples throughout the kingdom. And in verse 11, it says, the king's edict does this. It granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the same day that Haman's edict was to take effect. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers riding the royal horses raced out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was also issued in the citadel of Susa. So this decree grants the Jews the right to protect themselves and to kill their enemies and to plunder their goods on the same day that Haman has allowed these other people to attack and kill them and take their goods. So the 13th day of the 12th month is going to be D-Day for everyone. Verse 15, it says, Mordecai left the king's presence wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and in every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. There are three things that I want to point out here. First, I want us to see the honor that's now bestowed on Mordecai. He goes out from the king's presence wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large gold crown, and a purple robe. The honor that Haman had wanted for himself is now Mordecai's. Proverbs 1:19 says, such is the end of all who go after ill-gotten gain. It takes away the lives of those who get it. And Haman is certainly such a man. He went after ill-gotten gain, and it has taken his life away from him. The second thing is I want us to see the issuing of this new edict in behalf of the Jews brought about a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. Now, the reason for the joy and the happiness is obvious, I think. The Jews were given the opportunity for life again. But the reason for honor is not quite so obvious. The Jews were honored because a royal edict has been issued in their behalf. With this new edict, they are transformed from a people who had every ounce of dignity stripped from them through Haman's edict, and now instead they are now a people given special privilege by the king himself to defend themselves and to kill their enemies. Verse 15 says, and the city of Susa held a joyous celebration, which implies that it's not just the Jews who are celebrating, but it's all the people in the city celebrating. You may remember when Haman issued his edict back in Esther chapter 3, verse 15, it said that the whole city was bewildered. Justice is being reestablished in the kingdom, and the people are rejoicing, not just the Jews. Proverbs 14:34 says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. The third thing I want us to see is in verse 17 where it says, and many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. People have differing opinions about what was causing people to become Jews. Some think that it was simply out of fear for their lives that they're converting to Judaism in name. I personally think there's something deeper going on here than that. I believe the hand of God working in the midst of the Jewish people is apparent to everyone. The people are not simply becoming Jews for show, but they're turning to the God of the Jews because they're seeing the work of the true and living God taking place before them. We see the same kind of thing taking place in the book of Acts, for example, in Acts 2:47. People are turning to the Lord in large numbers because of the work of God that they are witnessing. Acts 4:21, people turn to the Lord after witnessing the healing of the crippled man by Peter. People are looking for the real thing. They were looking for it in Esther's day, and they're looking for it in our day. The people in the Persian Empire were witnessing the real thing taking place in front of them. It causes them to fear, but it also causes them to follow. The same thing will happen in our life. When we devote ourselves to the Lord and live uncompromising lives for Him, we earn the respect of those outside, and we will see people drawn to Christ through our example. I mean, I can think about in my own life, one of the things that drew me to Christ was getting to know some people who really lived what they said they believed. Jesus was real to those people, and He became real to me as I got to know those people and the Jesus that they followed. Verse 1 of Esther 9, it says, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. So the day has arrived. This is the day, 13th of the 12th month. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities and all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them, because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews, because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed all of the 10 sons of Haman, and I'm not even going to try to read their names. Last sentence of verse 10 says, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. By not taking anything of their enemies, the Jews honored God and demonstrated that they did not have personal gain at heart, even though the edict allowed them to take anything they wanted from their enemies. This was the practice many times in the Old Testament when God would give His people victory over their enemies, the plunder was left untouched as an offering to the Lord, as an act of worship to the Lord, a dedication to Him, an acknowledgement that anything and everything in their life had been given to them by God. And so here, they honor God in the same way that their ancestors had before, by not touching that plunder, that was God's. Verse 11, it says, the number of those slain in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. The king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? It will also be granted. If it pleases the king, Esther answered, give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king asks Esther, what else would you like me to do for you? And she says, give us the permission to carry out this same edict one more day, just in the capital city. Apparently, they had many enemies in Susa itself. He granted them that permission and then hung the 10 sons of Haman on the gallows to further humiliate him. Verse 20. Says, Mordecai recorded these events And he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and the 15th days of the month of Adar as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jewish festival called Purim, or Purim, depending on how you want to say it, was instituted. And it's still celebrated to this day in honor and memory of what the Lord did for his people during the days of Mordecai and Esther. The word pur means lot. And you may remember back in Esther chapter 3, verse 7, Haman cast the pur, or the lot, to determine what day he was going to attack the Jews and have them exterminated. Purim is the plural form of the word lot. And this is where the word Purim or Purim comes from. So it's a festival of lots. Sometimes they refer to it that way. So Purim or lots. Esther 10, I want to close with the last verse of the book, verse 3, chapter 10. It says, Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. I pray that the same words can be spoken about each of us in our day as people look back over our life. In closing this morning, the message of the book of Esther is one of tremendous hope for the people of God. First, the Lord is watching over us and taking care of us. He will never leave you or forsake you. He stood by his people in Esther's day. He will stand by you in your day. You may not see God all of the time. He may be hidden from your view at times, but that doesn't mean he's not there. Second, the all-powerful hand of our God is able to accomplish his will. And he will do it. Third, let us follow the example of Esther and Mordecai, who trust in their God in the midst of what appears to be one of the greatest disasters imaginable. They are fully committed to him. They never waver in that. They never question him. They always make themselves available to him. And he uses them to accomplish the saving of his people. He wants to use you and me in our day too. Give yourself to the Lord. 2 Chronicles 16:9 says, For the eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. Fourth and finally, recognize the possibilities that exist for where you are at in life right now. Remember Esther 4:14, Mordecai said to Esther, Who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this? And who knows but that you have come to the position that you have in life right now for such a time as this. The Lord is at work right now around you. Be a part of the work that he's doing. Be a part of his plan. The last thing I'd like to do is I want to go over quickly a little bit about the Jewish tradition of Purim, so that you understand what this special holiday is about that they have. Purim is one of the most joyful of all the Jewish holidays. In fact, it has been called the Jewish Mardi Gras. The word Purim means lots, referring to the casting of the lots, and the Purim celebration, as I already said, is sometimes called the festival or feast of lots. Purim is celebrated on the 14th day of Adar, which is usually the month of March in our calendar. And the next Purim celebration will be March 20, 2008. We already missed it for this year, so you might want to mark your calendar if you're going to celebrate Purim. One of the main teachings that comes out of the book of Esther is how God often works in ways that are hidden or behind the scenes. It may appear to be mere chance and circumstances, but in reality, the sovereign hand of God is always present, always at work, working everything out according to his plan and for his ultimate good. Now, this idea comes out repeatedly in the various things that are done as part of the Purim celebration. The celebration itself, there's usually a minor fast on the day before Purim to commemorate the fasting and the prayer for 3 days that Esther and the other Jewish people did before she went in to attempt to speak to the king. On the day of Purim, the book of Esther is read. And the book of Esther is referred to as the Megillah, which means scroll. So the Megillah is read, and it's customary for those in the audience to boo and hiss and stamp their feet and rattle noisemakers called gragers whenever the name of Haman is mentioned as the book is read. The purpose of that custom is to blot out the name of Haman. So as it's being read and they would come to the name of Haman, they'll boo, hiss, ah! And they would shout his name right out of existence. They still do it. You are to eat and drink and be merry on this day. The Talmud actually says, and I quote, a person is to drink until he can't tell the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordecai. Now, some have said it means to drink until you can't tell the difference between good and bad and right and wrong. There's differing opinions on just how drunk you are to get, but you're getting onto the idea, I would think. Their teaching and logic goes like this. The reason behind getting drunk on this day is to loosen your reliance on your intellect for an explanation of everything so that you'll begin to see things the way God does. Even though things look bad from our point of view, God is working everything out for good ultimately. So the idea behind drinking until you can't tell the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordecai is this, is that from our limited perspective, there is a difference. But from God's infinite perspective, there's no difference. He works it all out ultimately for his good and purpose. Whether it's Haman or it's Mordecai, they all ultimately end up serving his purpose. Now, please don't leave here today thinking that I am advocating that you get drunk so that you can see things the way God does. Okay? I'm merely sharing with you some of the Jewish tradition and thinking about the holiday of Purim. You're supposed to send gifts of food and drink and give to charities on this day. Carnival-type celebrations are held with plays and parodies and beauty contests. It's common for people to dress up in costumes and wear masks. It's to commemorate almost everything associated with the story. Esther's true identity was hidden from everyone except Mordecai until the very end. She was wearing a mask, so to speak. God's presence and activity is hidden from everyone until the very end. Everything appears to be going one way in the story until the end when it goes a completely different direction. It's a story that's wrapped in disguise, hidden behind costume, concealed behind a mask. A common treat that is given as part of Purim is Hamantaschen, which literally means Haman's pockets or Haman's ears. Hamantaschen are triangular-shaped fruit-filled cookies that are supposed to represent the three-cornered hat that Haman supposedly wore. These cookies also carry this idea of disguise and concealment because the cookie appears to be one thing on the outside, a very plain pastry, but inside it's got this sweet fruit jam. I've made some Hamantaschen for you to try. No kidding. It's back there on that back table. I made it last night for you. So help yourself at the end of worship service today. So you can try some of that. There are a number of recipes for Hamantaschen that are out there, but the one that I chose to use is a very simple one that's very old world and traditional. So it's a very simple recipe, and I think it gives you a better appreciation for the ideas that are represented within what it's supposed to be. So there you go. Let's bow our heads in prayer. Father, we thank you for the story of Esther. God, that you are present always, no matter what it looks like to us. Oftentimes, you feel distant to us, Lord, hidden away behind some curtain somewhere. But you have said, never will you leave us, never will you forsake us, never will you leave us as orphans, Lord. You are always present, always there, always at work. God, we ask that you would help us to trust you with our lives, especially in these times when it feels like you're so distant. You were always right there. I ask you to comfort your people today with that precious truth, Lord, in Christ's name. Amen.